The following is a paid program, and the opinions expressed within it are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of KACO Radio or Mulman Media Management and staff.
Welcome, this is Joe Poe
and Mary Helen Deere,
hosting Kiowa Talk, created by the late J.T. Goombay. Our sponsors for Kiowa Talk here on Saturday on New Country 98.5 FM, Apache, Anadarko, Lawton, Fort Sill, R, Kiowa's for a Better Future, District 5 Legislator Anita Johnson, District 7 Legislator Jacob Sotai, and Lawrence Spotted Bird, recently announced candidate for Kiowa Chairman. And to open up the show, we'll have Jacob Sotai. We'll turn the show over to him to give our opening prayer. Jacob, how have you been doing this week?
Thank you, Joe, and I'm honored again to be able to do this. Let us pray. Ahodoki, Creator, we thank you for this beautiful day. We thank you for the opportunity you have given to us to be of service to our people. We ask your blessing, continued blessing, on our people, especially our elders, as they carry with them knowledge, wisdom, and our oral tradition that are so badly needed for us to maintain our identity as Koigi. We ask that you would be with our children as they confront the system of education. May their journey be taken with an open heart to learn, open mind to absorb, and open eyes so that they know that what they are learning is of value. We ask you to be with our servicemen and women, those who are on front lines during this pandemic and the other healthcare people who watch over those who are in crisis during this time of danger. May you also guide the leaders of our tribe, that they may take their job with the seriousness that it requires, to really concentrate on the critical issues that confront our people. And may you help to guide those who are delivering our stimulus program, that they remain diligent and focused to be able to distribute those payments as efficiently as possible. And may you be with those who receive the payments so that they can spend this resource wisely and as it was intended. So continue to lead us and guide us. Forgive us if we have not reflected your light in our life, and keep us open to all of life's possibilities. Aho, Doc. Amen.
Thank you for that wonderful prayer, Jacob. All right. So next portion of our show, we're going to turn this over to Mary Helen Deere, and she's going to be interviewing our Kiowa Elder of the Week, which is Kirk Kickingbird. Mary Helen, go ahead.
Hello, Kirk.
Hi, Mary Helen.
I'm so glad you were able to join us today. Hardly ever get a chance to speak with you. You're so busy. But tell us, we start off with the elder in finding out, you know, whenever you meet somebody, you always say, who's your folks? And so we want to know, begin with, Kirk, who's your folks?
Well, I'm a little taken aback by the title elder. I mean, I think of Lynn Pawdy or Guy Quitone as elders.
Or your dad.
but maybe that's part of what the transition in time that you're trying to get at in your interviews is about. My dad is Carl Kickingbird, and they had a place about 7 miles west of Anadarko there at Apache Y up in the hill. My grandmother had remarried Glenn Stumbling Bear. So to Pearl Ware and Glenn Stumbling Bear after my grandfather died. I think it was a tuberculosis epidemic in those days, back in the around 1920 or so. And my mom's a Potawatomi. Grew up in Newkirk in a ranch nearby, Ark City in Newkirk. So that's just the my immediate family there.
Okay. So tell me, Kirk, I knew you when you were a teen and early 20s and such, but how did you grow up? And how did that growing up and the teachers from your mother and your father and your grandparents affect you as a child in growing up? And then later, how did that transition into your adult life in what you decided to do with your life?
I think it's the support they provided, both in school and sports and other activities. You kind of a foundation gave me a lot of confidence. For a time, we lived in Duncan, I can remember visiting with my grandparents coming up often every other weekend and sometimes several weeks during the summer. Dad was a line-top operator and worked for Duck and Banner, and then moved to El Reno and worked for the El Reno Tribune there. So he was always, as a line-top operator, he was not only setting the type, but he was reading the stories. And so he always encouraged me when reading, as did my mother. And that's provided a good, solid foundation. Most of my time was spent growing up in El Reno, and then, as I say, on the weekends or summers, we'd be down at Anadarko. I remember, Saturdays in Anadarko when you see some of these old photos where there's cars packed against the curb and then two rows of cars in the middle of the street. Those old streets were really wide. And that was a main day to come into town, and everybody got to visit. So Anadarko was a busy little town in those days. I think they had three motion picture theaters. Of course, that as a kid, that interested me quite a lot. And then at Apache Y there, just over the hill, was Red Stern Baptist Church. So we would go down there and on the weekends on Sunday and go to church there. So that was all the framework for my early years in grade school.
Yeah. So I know what you did when you were growing up, but tell some of the people about some of your experiences. How did you get to OU? Why did you decide to go into law? And how about some of your Indian activities at OU?
Because I had good support. I was encouraged in school to make good grades. Activities, like band and student council and all that sort of stuff. And out of that, I got a scholarship called from the President's Leadership Class that was created by George Cross, the president of OU, to encourage, I think it was about 50 high school students They picked out people of prominence at those schools, and you were brought in, and there was a special night, one night a week, where you got to hear from people at the university, professors, administrators, just to learn a little bit more about the inside of what goes on at the university and how it operated. And that was confidence building. It made you feel special. Made you feel like I had a place at the university. It was during the time in high school they put up, junior high, they put up, Russians had put up the Sputnik. And there was a big emphasis on science and math. And I had been looking about the possibility of medicine as a career. But I'd been in speech contest in high school and done well. We used to visit a lot of the universities around the state for these speech contests. I guess that was also another way the university was recruiting. And so out of that, I thought I might do better, doing speaking and out of the debate class, all the kind of prep you do. And so those are factors that I majored in history and in political science with the intent then of going into the law school and went straight into undergrad. Part of it was, I think, hearing stories from my dad about things that happened dealing with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, land issues, inheritance issues, the working with, or lack of working with tribal governments by the BIA. All those kind of factors kind of weighed on my mind, and it's something or a way to use the legal background.
You talked about the atmosphere at that time of maybe guiding you into a career of law. How about the atmosphere when you were in school? I don't know if you ever talk about it, but you represented the Indian students there at OU. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think it was my second year of college. They had an opening on the cheerleading squad for the mascot, the Little Red. Danny Timmons was the student who had preceded me, and I had a non-Indian guy who was my roommate. He said, "Hey, have you seen this?" And showed me the newspaper article. And he said, "You ought to try out for it." So I did a little inquiry about it before I tried out for it. Come down to Anadarko, and yeah, took me around. We talked about probably six or eight elders, at least I thought they were elders. I was about 19, so I know that some of those guys had served in World War II, so they could only have been about 45 or 50. Certainly elders to me, and I asked them what they thought about this Little Red thing. They had encouraged me to do it, and they kind of all had the same outlook. The idea of an Indian being out there prominently with the university, particularly a university that had a winning football team, with the idea that this would be a positive image of saying this university is a place where Indians ought to be. And so with that encouragement, I tried out and got it. And then for a number of years got to go to all the football games and was out there prominently. And You did teach me how to deal with public a little bit about Indian issues. I remember one time probably a 10-year or 11-year-old boy came up to me and said, "Hey, what do you do when you're not being Indian?" And he was just looking at the feathers and such. I said, "Well, I'm always an Indian. I'm just not always dressed like this." And I think that's a common perception in those times that it was an occupation, so to speak. But I got to go to Miami and Lincoln, Dallas and Houston and a lot of places because of the position on the cheerleading squad.
Yeah, I remember my classmate Phil Waller was Little Red for a while. I think he probably was to your being there, because Phil would have been my age, and I'm older than you, so I'm more elderly than you.
Well, I don't think of you as an elderly.
Well, thank you. But I
recently, someone put up a picture on Facebook that had Phil and me in it. It must have been, I think, at a powwow at OCU, probably back in the 90s. So Phil would come by every once in a while and say goodbye, say hello, come down to the edge of the stadium there, those first rows, and wave me over and say hello. Mm-hmm. So I got to know him a little bit.
Yeah, it was sad. He died too young, and he was always a joy to be around. He was fun to be around. How about the influence of AIM during that time?
I don't recall there much being going on. It was just the beginning of protest and action. I do remember occasionally Clyde Warrior at some event talking, but there was not that much protest yet. I think that built in the 2 to 3 years after I'd left. It's kind of like fashion, the East Coast and West Coast get it, but Oklahoma's about 3 or 4 years behind. And I think it's the same way on social movements like that. They just don't reach here as quickly. Although there was a lot of stuff beginning to build in the newspaper, there was a book out called Red Power by a guy named Alvin Giuseppe. And somebody asked Clyde, "What do Indians want?" And he said, "Give us the bomb." And that turned out to be quite controversial among some folks. I just thought it was funny. When I got back, got to D.C., it was during that area when President Nixon had just put in his Indian policy statement, which is probably the best one in the second half of the 20th century. And he had 11 pieces of legislation to put more hands and transform our authority to tribal governments. Indian Self-Determination Act was one of those pieces of legislation, but it's probably 5 years later before it passed. So some things were beginning to happen, but at the same time, protests were building, and I'd gone to work at 69 at the BIA in the Congressional Relations Office, and bureaucracy was not really for me, so I'd left in 71, and then 72 we had the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and then in the spring of 73 we had the siege of Wounded Knee, and Brian DeLoria and I were running a legal research center on Indian law, trying to use treaties and Indian law to help support tribal governments and getting more control. And I remember Russell came by our office there in D.C., and Brian just happened to be in town because he was in Denver at the time. And he was talking to us a little bit about what was going on at Wounded Knee. And later Russell was charged, and Brian and I flew up to meet John Thorne in Lincoln, Nebraska, to talk about elements we could use for help or suggest for Russell and the defense. And Thorne called me as an expert witness on treaties in that case. So ended up testifying and support Russell. So, I'm sure, I think those are the days when you were in New York City. So you saw a lot of that. You had full of people and the Indians being interviewed in some of the major morning shows.
Yeah, that was an exciting time, for Indian Affairs. And I knew that, you know, you were a part of it. And a lot of people don't recognize all the background work that was done, you know, to get the legislation that we enjoy today, such as self-determination. And
it was in those days, it felt like there were just a handful of us, Ryan and Frank Bishnow and John Echohawk and some of those guys were we're all working towards the same goal, not always working on the same thing at the same time. In fact, when they started the Indian Education Act in 1972, despite the supportive Indian policy statement of Nixon, his administration had impounded the money. That is, they wouldn't spend it. And John Gosper out of Tulsa and I were asked by Vine to put together a lawsuit for to help an Indian family up in Montana. I think it was Al Redman and his son. And it was Redman versus Altina was the case, Altina being the Commissioner of Education. And fortunately, the language in the appropriation bill required that the money be spent, that shall. And so he sued to make sure it got spent and won that case, started the Indian Education Act. There was a little bit of that, but a lot of policy stuff, a lot of scampering around Congress, federal agencies, and so forth. But like I said, didn't feel like there were that many of us, so it was always a crisis. Someone had something and some problem with EIA funding or U.S. Office of Education funding. Things were popping, and then of course we got the Wounded Knee, which caused the creation of that congressional study, the American Indian Policy Review Commission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, hearing that. I wasn't really involved with that as much as I was involved with the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act, and which established congressional funding for the urban Indian clinics. And that are, you know, many are still thriving today and have grown beyond what they were back in the 70s.
Well, that, of course, was a real big fight about how to get funding to urban Indians on a variety of programs because they were elected to do so. I mean, it's hard enough getting funding for programs in Indian country and reservations. And there's a real reluctance. That was one of the things in Nixon's policy statement, was to provide better funding avenues for urban Indians. Mm-hmm. It was also about the time that, you know, we're, as always, concerned about land issues. And I had done that book, 100 Million Acres. I think that's when you guys put me up, you and your husband put me up two or three times. I'd come to D.C. I'd come to New York City to deal with my editors, which were actually Vine Deloria's editors, and also get funding for our legal research.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember. Well, I'm getting signals over here, so we're coming to the end of our time. So considering all of your experience that you've done and the help that Indian people today are enjoying but really don't know that background, so what advice would you give to young people going to school now?
Well, certainly it's really study hard. Do as well as you can for a couple of reasons. One is to be effective in the profession you've chosen and do. Possibly get access to scholarship funding to make sure you get that education. You have to often work quietly and for a long time to get some things done. It's not always a quick fix for anything. And I know that, I spent 7 years in the United States in college with a green undergrad and law school. And so it's sometimes frustrating, but it certainly is a reward because it enables you and gets you the skill you need to have to help Indian communities, Indian tribes, Indian governments, and your larger family in that community. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Kirk. I really appreciate this and listening to some of the stories of those days gone by and doing whatever we could as individuals to help Indian people improve their lives. So I thank you for the work that you've done and continue to do, and thank you for being on today.
Thank you, Emma. Bye-bye now.
Yeah, Kirk, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be on our show. We appreciate it. All right, everybody, that was Kirk Kickingbird, and he it was our Kiowa Elder of the Week. For our next part of the show, we try to cover all things Kiowa here, and we have an upcoming hand game season. And Mary Beaver, are you there with us today?
I am.
All right, so we'll turn the show over to Mary, and she's going to update us on the upcoming hand game schedule coming up in November. Mary, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to give you the Kiowa Crow hand game schedule as I got it. We're going to start out Wednesday, November the 10th, and Camp 7 from around the Cache area will host the Crows. Location unknown. November the 11th, the Bearchill family and the senior hand game team will host the Crows, and we're actually going to have a tournament this year, and the details are still being worked out on that. The tournament will be at the Carnegie Fair building. And then on Friday the 12th, the Kozak family, and their location is Carnegie. Saturday the 13th, Joe Fish DuPont will be hosting the Crows at Carnegie. And on Sunday, the Challengers will be hosting the Crows, and that location is also Carnegie. So with that said, that's the short version of the schedule. So.
All right, Mary, thank you for coming on, and let me know if you've got any further updates, and we'll go from there. Mary Helen Deere, she's got...
I will.
All right, Mary, you have a nice day. Thank you so much. Mary Helen Deere has a few comments she'd like to make today about today being a special day. Mary, go ahead.
Yeah, Thursday, September 30th, was the National Truth and Reconciliation Day. And we were supposed to wear orange to honor and remember the children who didn't come home, as well as those who survived and their families. But we shouldn't do that for just one day. Currently, there are 6,509 children that have been unearthed. Some have gone home to have honor ceremonies to be buried back at home, that they finally came home. So remember our children, always. Thank you.
All righty, Mary, thank you for that update. Next, we have a special guest in our office, in our studio here, to make a few comments about certain current events going on in the tribe. And I've got Jared Tartza. Jared, go ahead.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Mary Helen. Appreciate it. That was a lovely interview there with Kirk Kickingbird and Mary Beaver's update there. So I was taking a look at the recall effort that we had initiated, which we submitted those signatures on, was it May 25th? May 25th was our date for submitting those petitions. We submitted those petitions just to go ahead and follow through, and we wanted to have it on record to show that there were 1,050 tribal members that willingly signed to recall the chairman for various reasons.
Well, that looks like that's a lot more people than voted for him, doesn't it, Jared?
I believe so. Yeah. I believe it's, what, is it double?
Well, I'm not sure.
It's over double. Okay. Yeah, it's two times the amount. So we didn't get to go ahead and finish the recall effort for whatever reasons that there were. Whenever we submitted our recall petitions, and this is something that I've been quiet about, whenever we submitted our recall petitions...
Until today.
And I would, given the American Rescue Plan team and the COVID-19 team, their what is it called? The response center?
Non-response center, more like.
Well, you know. Well, we have the latest document that the tribe has submitted. See, they had been going and issuing out a document each day showing the status on how many checks that they had processed. So the last time that the tribe has updated the tribal members and the public with any information in regards to the American Rescue Plan Act monies, which is the $2,200 to all adult tribal members, well, the last time that they've updated was on September 15th, and it looks like the last number that we show is there had been 7,371 checks printed, and the applications to date are 10,431. So there are some outstanding checks to be processed right now. And I want everybody to look at this. If you go on to Kiowas for Better Future, you can look at this. It'll be pinned up at the top. You can see the document for yourself. And it's also on the Kiowa Tribe website and their Facebook page. Look at May 25th. If you look from August 25th, I'm sorry, August 25th was our date to submit these petitions, not May. So August 25th. We submitted our petitions to the Election Commission. August 27th, there was 452 checks printed. August 30th, there were 397 checks printed. August 31st, we start seeing a decline. 149 checks were printed. September 1st, a significant decline of only 79 checks printed. September 2nd, 130 checks printed. And then we have some closures on September 3rd and the 6th. And then we come back to the 7th, and we have 97 processed. And the numbers just kind of just dwindle. We never get back up to 100 being processed. And this is the amount of checks that they're processing a day. Now, they were processing at their highest that they were processing. They had 661 in one day. And then they had 456 the day prior, 246 the day prior to that. So and this is just a working hypothesis that whenever we submitted our petitions, their productivity went down drastically on the amount of checks that they produced.
They're writing one-tenth the amount of checks they were before.
Right.
Well, people could still sign the recall petition.
Right.
So I wonder what that's attributable to, Jared.
I'm not sure, but I do want everybody to know that whenever we submitted our the petitions, the Kiowa Election Commission asked myself to meet them at the Judicial Branch Center, which is the former Head Start building. Typically, anytime we've turned in our submissions of petitions regarding the elections, it's been there at the election office. And throughout COVID, we have submitted all of our documents either outside the election office or inside the Election Commission office. But that day, we were asked to meet them at the Judicial Branch Center, where they had us go into the courtroom that they had built up there, and we submitted our petitions there. Well, after we went ahead and submitted the petitions, Miss Amanda Hill, the chairman, she went ahead and she went with security to go make copies of these petitions so that I could go ahead and have a record. We all wanted to have a copy. Whenever she made the copies, it didn't dawn on me to think that, oh, technology nowadays, whenever you go scan the document into the printers, that could be saved and that could compromise. Well, I had spoken with somebody that works with the tribe, and this is very truthful. This is actually what they had told me, was whenever the document is over 100 pages, it is automatically saved to an administrator's email. And we had over 300 pages of these signatures that we were scanning in. So they were automatically saved to some administrator. I'm not saying that it was a court administrator, or if it was the food distribution administrator, or if it was the maintenance director, whoever it was. I don't know who it was, but there was an administrator that was tied to the IT right there where it was synced and it was saved to. So it could have gone to anybody that had access to it. So there was a compromise and a breach in that information. And we had notified the Election Commission right after it happened, and they were told us that they would get back with us. And it's been, what, a month or so, and we haven't heard a word on that issue. And then we see the productivity just declining. And it's just an issue here that we see, and I just can't understand why we were told to meet at the Judicial Center to utilize their scanning device whenever we could have done that there at the Election Commission office. Now that's just a hypothesis. Now it is it's testable. I would like for it to be debunked. I would like for all 10,431 members to get their checks. It shouldn't take us having to scream around and try to reach out to people, and it shouldn't take pulling teeth to get your check. It's such a shame. It's a disgrace at what the administration has done.
So there's over 3,000 Kiowas that still haven't gotten their check.
That's right.
And the check productivity has gone down from 600 a day down to 40 a day now. So at that rate, it's going to take...
Actually, we're not even being informed anymore.
Oh, yeah. We're not even being informed. So
that's another thing is... The executive team has told the public that there were 20-plus programs outside of this individual payment to the individuals of the $2,200. There were 20 or so programs that were supposed to be utilized to help offset whatever it might have been, financial hardship, whatever it was. They had programs for housing, whatever. The tribal members have not had access to any kind of application, any kind of programs with how they will assist. So at this time, it's just a free fall.
I mean, this is just another, just a continuation on of non-transparency in our tribal finances, and while Adolf Hitler just runs amok.
I heard that that the chairman said that he told people not to listen to the negativity. Well, don't cause the negativity, and we won't have anything to worry about.
That's right.
Those 3,000-plus... checks that have not been distributed, would that be the children?
No, these say 10,000. Well, I'm not sure if they would be children or not, because these right here show the applications that have been received by the adults, because right now the children, the minors, is a whole separate deal. I believe that we had around 10,000 adults, and was it like 2,000 children?
Yeah.
Like 12,000 altogether?
Something like that.
The numbers are off. So it's kind of hard for us to make heads of anything without valid information. So all I know is that the decline has begun since we submitted our petitions over. It's just maybe coincidence. It's hard to say that's a coincidence. It's deliberate.
All right, Jared, you got anything else?
No, I just want everybody to know that if they're calling the 580-951-0365 number for the COVID assistance, the ARPA number, and you don't get anybody, I would email COVID19@KiowaTribe.org or COVID19AST@KiowaTribe.org or FSatePataw@KiowaTribe.org.
All right, Jared. Well, you make sure you call me if you got something that you need to say and you coming down here in the show and talk on the show. And make sure you wait around because we're going to go to Jake's afterwards.
Well, I hope they go ahead and get those checks out to the people because those people need the money.
They sure do. I agree. All right. Jared, thanks you for coming in and giving us that update. All right. Next up on the show is our legislative update, and I'm hoping Anita Johnson's there with us. Anita, are you with us today?
Yes, I am.
Yes. The floor is yours, ma'am. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say a few things about the Indian City acreage, the attendance there at the signing of the near 200 acres of land from fee land to trust land, and the occasion there last week, which was attended well, and it just was a good occasion. There was also an occasion back several months ago that took place at Hobart in Kiowa County, and there were a few, just maybe less than 25 people there, I didn't see any kind of a hoopla or any meal or anything to acknowledge that signing of that land that was a gift. We didn't have to pay for that at all. And that also was a fee to trust property. And that's been going on for a while. Know that the Indian City property did not start in 19. It started years ago, and Hobart started several years ago also. But the main thing that I wanted to say today was that there has been also a number of allotted land, which is also trust land already, that has been offered up to the Kiowa tribe for sale by individuals that own this property. It's allotted, are allotted lands that people want to sell. Well, the Kiowa tribe has first choice on that for sale lands that are individuals' property, allotted lands. And Kiowa tribe has not purchased those properties. For whatever reason, we have not purchased those properties. And one such explanation was, it doesn't, it wouldn't have any potential for any kind of feedback of any monetary gain. Well, that's not the purpose. It's to expand our property and to keep our individual allotment lands within the Kiowa tribe, because there's no more lands on this earth. That's it. So instead of increasing our tribal land, we certainly have allowed almost over 1,800 acres of land to go to non-Indian people for sale when we could have purchased that property ourselves. And that's, to me, that was an error, a big error on our part. So that's something that we certainly need to correct. Any property that goes up for sale, we need to purchase that just to increase our own our land base. Also, this past week, I went to a Medicine Lodge, Kansas, for a treaty signing memorial, peace treaty signing memorial, which is a big thing up there. There were over 6,000 people at the at this occasion. They treated it very well and respectful, much better than anything that goes on down here in this area for such a momentous historic happening. The people there were using that treaty signing, and they mentioned the Kiowa tribe. That's where the Kiowa tribe went to at the convergence of those two waterways to do their medicine up there in Kansas every year. And so since the military, the Army knew that this happened every year, they gathered that they would come there and have that peace treaty signing. And they gathered up the rest of the tribes because they knew the Kiowas were going to be there. And Comanches, there's five tribes that were there. The Comanches, the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Apaches, and the Kiowa tribe. And they said that's the largest gathering of chieftains of all those tribes to ever gather. It was a very historic thing. And that's the way those people up there treat that occasion. And it was really something to see. I never wanted to go there because I felt bad about it. But I was glad that I made that trip. First time I've ever made it, first time I've ever been there. And I came away with a respect for that, that the men that were there with full knowledge of what they were doing. Didn't really want to do it, but they knew what the future held for them if they didn't do it. And it was an eye opener. And the way the people there that came from all over. And I asked a little bit about what's the largest crowd the people that I talked to had seen. And they said, several years ago, they had about 10,000 people that came to that. So it's just a big occasion in that area. And I just was impressed. They have a nice power grounds there. that they have developed, and it's going to get nicer. That's what we were told, that it's going to become nicer than it has. There's a man that volunteers to do that. He's from that area, and it's something that he envisioned. And Mr. The Kawa Princess father works with him, and he comes out of Wichita, and it's about an hour and a half drive. So he said he doesn't get to get over there very often, but he helps this fellow out. But it just was a really a nice weekend occasion. And that is part of our ancestral land there. I would like to encourage someone to do some research on that. There might be something that the Kiowa tribe can do in that area, since that does belong to us in a ancestral way, that particular spot. And it would be a good idea to just go and view where our people used to gather at the convergence of those two waterways, just to remember that our people used to be there every year for historical purposes. But it was something to see. And it was too much for me to try to go down to that, but a younger person could very well go down there. And maybe our lands man could go down there and make a trip and go see what he can see down there. But it was nice. I really enjoyed it. We're trying to finalize our budget. We still have not had a chance to even vote on the veto override yet on the last budget, and that's coming up. We're trying to do a legislative order on that, and also we have to do a legislative order on some other things, and one of them being the KIC coordinator. That's already we've already had a set of precedents on that when we went between the first coordinator and the second coordinator that's still in place right now. Although it's not an active coordinator, we still have one in place. And so we'd like to see something happen for the KIC. The legislators who I'm talking about would like to see something happen for the KIC. And we're hoping that this can come about. I'm looking forward to this fall season, you know, for the Kiowa people, and I'm glad that we're getting to getting a lot of the money out to the Kiowa tribe, and I'm hoping that if we get a budget passed, some more money will come out because our budget calls for $3,000 per head. Per head, not per age group. And I'm hoping that will occur. I want that to occur for our Kiowa people. But that's about it for me, Mr. Poe and Mrs. Deer. That's about it for me this week.
All right. Anita, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. I know you just attended the funeral. Sorry for your loss, but we'll look forward to talking to you this week, and we'll see you on the show next week. All righty?
I have something to interject on that. On the land buyback during the Cobell settlement, this was a huge failure of the Comalte administration by not getting involved.
Yeah, he didn't turn it in on the deadline.
Because we could have been buying back lands, but after speaking with the realty out at the agency, the Comalte administration never even entertained the thought of being part of that program to help buy back some of these. A lot of them they're cut up where they have multiple owners, and those are right there where your prime allotments that you want to buy back is the ones that have been encumbered by multiple owners.
He's being fractionated.
Yep. He did not do it, and that was a huge failure on that administration's part there, because we now have lands that are now going to be either sold to outsiders or just not even
Yep. I agree. All right, Anita, thank you, and we'll talk to you here in a few days. All right, so the next portion of our show is we've got Jacob Sotai to give his legislative update. Jacob, could you take it away, please, sir?
Well, thank you, Joe, and I don't have too much to add to what Legislator Johnson has already stated, except that we are working on a draft budget that we will continue to work on until our next monthly session. Legislator Primus is heading up that effort to develop a comprehensive budget that we hope will be passed and will be signed into law. Otherwise, we'll have to work at, again, another veto override. But we'll see how that works. We do know we need a budget critically because the administration continues to convey the sense that we don't have money. And when the Constitution clearly states that we revert back to the previous budget as a starting point, not as the ending point. So we don't have to finish out this year's budget completely. We start over. It says to revert back as a starting point, the figures from last year's budget. We just can't add line items. We can't increase any of the line items that are there. But we just maintain the expenditures that are in last year's budget. And we start from the beginning. Each budget has a set amount that's been approved by the KIC. One of the areas that has been really unfortunate that they don't recognize that the Constitution intends for us to reaffirm our budget amount is the social services. They have been telling our citizens that there is no money, where they ran out of money, which it would be the case if we were sticking to the concept of a one budget figure for the year. But if we don't approve a budget, we are allowed to utilize the figures from last year's budget. So that's a sticking point. We need to have somebody realize that they're hurting their citizens needlessly by not addressing the budget in a realistic way, the way the Constitution had intended for us to. But if we, you know, we'll pass this budget in October, then we'll have a completely new budget, and we'll have additional line items that will be considered and added to our budget expenditures. And so we're just hoping that we get that passed. That is the main item that we need to consider and to move forward. And hopefully the administration and the chairman will consider it likewise. And sign off on the new budget, and in order to give us new money, increased line items for us to better serve our people. That's the main thing. I do know that there is clamoring for a constitutional amendment to lower the blood quantum, and we need to have hearings on that to see the practicalities of that issue. But I do know there are many, many citizens who really want that to be the Constitution to be amended so we can add to our enrollment figures. Many of the grandchildren have gone out of the eligibility realm because they are below the quarter degree blood quantum. And I do know that it's something that takes a lot of time and consideration. And so hopefully we will be able to have some community meetings on that in order to really develop a comprehensive plan on the pros and cons of that issue. But that's something that is on the horizon.
Hey, Jacob, one thing I want to discuss before you get away today. A while back, the KIC drafted a resolution to require the tribe have a forensic audit. And I know that that was put in the budget for last year to do a forensic audit, yet for some reason,
right. There
hasn't been a forensic audit, and the chairman doesn't want one. Why would the chairman not want a forensic audit? And what can we do, or do we have planned to force his hand to make that happen? I know that if we did have a forensic audit, I know that a couple of items that I'm aware of that I've seen the receipts, like one, his pills for his male enhancement, and his other one of embezzlement by his one of the tribal employees through an ACH deposit of nearly $20,000. So, and a forensic audit would cover these things, and we already have the bank records and the receipts, and we already have those things have been turned over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So what can we do to further that forensic audit?
Well, one avenue would be to go to CFR court and get a writ of mandamus, and that's something that we have talked about. And, you know, we may get to the point that becomes reality. Because it becomes critical when we learn more and more about some of the CARES Act expenditures. And when you talk about the federal dollars, that brings in the other element of the Office of Inspector General on how some of those monies might have been misappropriated. So there are two or three different fronts that can bring into consideration some of the allegations that have been made. Yes, we do have that as a line item. There has been a reluctance, a resistance to that for whatever reason. You know, we can all speculate, but until we find the proof and the evidence, we can't really move forward with any kind of accountability. And that's what's needed, accountability of those dollars and where they were spent and how much and all of that, which will be uncovered with forensic audit. So, we're very near where that becomes a reality, where the legislature goes to CFR court to move that forward and request a writ of mandamus to have that done. We did hear that at the Indian City ceremony that audits have been conducted and they've come back clean. And as far as a forensic audit, I don't think there was a mention of that.
Yeah.
So,
Jacob, that's my question. I'm confused as to, on one hand, the administration says that the audits have been completed. On the other hand,
right.
I've heard that the audits that are completed are only on the grant funds and the contract funds through BIA, but the tribal funds mm-hmm. from the casino and land tax, et cetera, mm-hmm. have not been audited. Do you know, is that true?
I don't know if that's true, but there was not a blanket statement about and a comprehensive audit, a forensic audit. And that's what we're looking at, something that encompasses all of our resources and expenditures, whether federal dollars or internal revenue.
Hey, Jacob.
So I would perceive that has not been the case.
Hey, Jacob, we're running out
of
we're running out of time, so I've got to sign off. But thank you for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you soon. All righty.
Thank you.
That was Jacob Sotai. We'd like to encourage everyone to get vaccinated. Please contact your closest IHS clinic. We'd also like to thank our guests, Kirk Kickingbird, Mary Beaver, and Jared Tarza, for being on the show today, and for all the Koigu people for tuning in to KACO New Country 98.5, Apache Anadarko, Lawton, Fort Sill. Please pray for the Kiowa people, and as JT would say, goombye for now.
The previous was a paid program, and the opinions expressed within it are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of KACO Radio or Mullman Media management and staff.
1 in 3 adults has prediabetes. 1 in 3. That means it could be you, your football buddy. Your football buddy. Or you, your best man. Your worst man. You, your dog walker. Your cat jogger. While 1 in 3 adults has prediabetes, with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. Take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. That's doihaveprediabetes.org.
Wait, did they just say one in three adults has prediabetes? That's 33.33333% of adults. That means it could be me, my boss, or my boss's boss, or me, my favorite sister, or my other sister. That's seven members of my 21-person romantic book club. Wait, the one in three could be me, my karaoke partner Carol, or my karaoke enemy Jeff. I'm going to take the risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.